Tonight on Arena, Paul Muldoon on the year's poetry, a new art exhibition in Banbridge, and Queen's A Night at the Opera at 50. You are very welcome along to Monday Night's Arena. You can text us on 51551. Our WhatsApp is 0870 32 32 32, and you can email arena@rte.ie. We are, of course, on Instagram at @RTE_arena. If the contemporary Irish poetry world has superstars, then one of them is the man sitting across from me. Paul Muldoon was published by Faber at the age of 21, and since then has had more than 30 collections to his name, along with a Pulitzer and the T.S. Eliot Prize. He's recently become a professor emeritus at Princeton, having taught there for more than 30 years. He's been poetry editor at The New Yorker and recently finished his 3-year stint as Ireland professor of poetry. He's also the brains and the brawn behind one of New York's cultural highlights, the Muldoon's Picnic Events. His own latest book is an anthology of his favourite sonnets called Scanty Plot of Ground, which features poems from John Donne to Sylvia Plath and from Yeats to Elizabeth Bishop. Paul, we're delighted to have you on Arena this evening.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to start with some of the poetry collections that you've chosen from this year that you've enjoyed most and that you're recommending to people. Has it been a good year for poetry?
I think every year is a good year for poetry, and particularly poetry in this case from Northern Ireland. I'm going to be jingoistic and cast my eyes up towards Belfast and the extraordinary group of poets who were based there, or substantially based there. I mean, it was the year, of course, in which we had the poems of Seamus Heaney, it's a massive item, and it's wonderful to have all of those poems in one place. And so it was thrilling to have that book appear this year with so many great poems in it. And I wonder sometimes, honestly, about all of the footnotes and the notes. I think it just makes it for the older set like myself. It just makes it slightly more unmanageable. But I'm not here to complain about that. I'm here to say what a wonderful book it is.
What did you make of it when you saw it first, when you first got your hands on it?
Well, you know, my impulse, to be honest, was, as I've just said, it's great to have these poems here. Some of the poems that were not collected over the years, I would be one of those people who, on balance, would say that there is a reason why they weren't collected. That's to say, they weren't included in freestanding collections. And most of the time, in my opinion, it's because they're not quite up there. And there's always something slightly dicey about that, even with the poet who's as secure, as it were, in his reputation as Seamus Heaney. They're all, as far as I'm concerned, dangers about that. The classic example of it a few years ago was the collection of poems by Elizabeth Bishop, which included pretty much everything she ever wrote. And there is, of course, a school of thought whereby everything an interesting poet wrote is interesting. I myself don't quite buy into that. So, as I say, great to have it. Great to have it. Also great to have the likes of Tom Pollan's new book, Na Man La, which is a book that, as they say, is hard won. I mean, Tom Pollan, it's no secret, I think, to say that Tom Pollan, because as the subject of a number of these poems, is the depression that he's undergone over the last few years. And he writes really quite movingly and beautifully about that experience. And so it's great to see Tom Pollan, who was out of the picture for a while there, you know, storming back. Fabulous to see those poems.
It seems to have been almost a decade since his last collection. Was it something that you were looking forward to?
It was. I mean, Tom Pollan is a poet who over the course of his long career, which, as I say, as you say, was he was not so much to the fore over the last few years. But it's great to have these new poems, very strong poems.
It's been a good year for the collection in general. It's shortlisted for the T.S. Eliot Prize and for the Penn Heaney Prize, which, as far as I'm aware, is being announced this evening in the National Library in the next hour or so.
Mm-hmm.
I saw Andrew O'Hagan in The Guardian say of that collection that many of the poems are filled with a sense of late style and unfinished business. Do you agree with that?
Well, you know, it's the notion of a late style, of course, is sometimes a complex one, because the fact of the matter is that for many poets, indeed for most poets, the longer they keep going, the less effective they become. That's just a very sad fact about poetry. I mean, the classic case is, of course, William Wordsworth, you know, who started on such a high and really tailed off right the way through his career. And I'm afraid that Wordsworth is normative for most poets. People say, well, what about W.B. Yeats? And of course, one says, yeah, what about W.B. Yeats? He did manage to write some really great poems towards the end. He also wrote a lot of less than great poetry. But he is certainly the person who's brought forward as the counter case to Wordsworth. In any case, you know, the important thing is that at whatever point they happen, really interesting poems may get written. You know, and it's great to see a poet in his later years writing so well. Same is true, of course, of Maeve McGuckian. Her new selected poems has just come out, and it's fabulous to see so many of her poems collected there. I mean, some of the old favourites included a poem like Slips, The Studied Poverty of a Moon Roof, The Earthenware of Dairies Cooled by Apple Trees, The Apple Tree That Makes the Whitest Wash. But I forget names, remembering them wrongly where they touch upon another name, a town in France, like a woman's Christian name. My childhood is preserved as a nation's history, my favourite fairy tales, the shells least, by the hermit crab. I see my grandmother's death as a piece of ice, my mother's slimness restored to her, my own key slotted in your door. Tricks, you might guess, from this unfastened button, a pen mislaid, a word misread, my hair coming down in the middle of a conversation. One of her all-time great poems, Slips.
And that Slips by Maeve McGuckian, read by Paul Muldoon. I saw you call her one of our most alert and alluring poets. What makes her so alluring?
Well, the allure is in her engagement with language. And, I mean, she is a poet who, I think, is, comparatively speaking, difficult. You know, and we shy away from difficulty. My own view on that is we live in a difficult world. And if poetry is to be equal to that world, it is necessarily difficult. Kieran Carson has a great line about that very topic, in fact. There is no one, he says, like McGuckian writing in the English language, and we should be grateful for her ornate and ambiguous presence. So ornate and ambiguous would be a way of thinking about it. Too often, Kieran Carson wrote, I have been asked, but what does it all mean? You might as well ask what Charlie Parker means. He means music. McGuckian means poetry. And, you know, the subject of many poems, dreary though it may be to remind oneself of it, is poetry itself. Not in any self-regarding way, but the poem coming into being is watching itself over its own shoulder.
Your anthology of sonnets called Scanty Plot of Ground, it features some of the greatest sonnets ever written. Why that form of poetry for an anthology? And why do you think that it's such a perfect length?
Well, I think that length is one of the reasons why it's been so enduring as a form. It is the perfect length. That poem by Maeve McGuckian that I read a moment ago, Slips, as it turns out, it's 15 lines. And there's something about that, roughly speaking, that duration, as we know, the sonnet, of course, for the most part, is 14 lines long. I mean, I think we better say it is, yeah, strictly speaking, 14 lines long. I mean, there have been some wonderful comments on that particular square footage, as it were, that the sonnet takes up. And there's a fellow called Michael Thune, for example, who says, off the sonnet's physical footprint, he says, formally, virtually every sonnet is, at least in part, a concrete poem that looks like a sonnet, right? So the space that Slips takes up is sonnet-like. So, but let's think more about it. There has to be more going on than that. Its duration is a major aspect also. Not only it's the amount of space it takes up, the amount of time it takes up. And then, for the most part, its method, which is to focus on either one or one and a half ideas, which is basically about as many as most of us can deal with. So that has been a major part of its success story, either in the famous Petrarchan sonnet, the Italian model, when it first came into English, which is, you know, we've got A, and here we have B, by slight contrast, B, one and a half ideas. In English, of course, the most famous method is Shakespeare's, where we've got this one idea, and then the notion, the ideas, is restated at the very end. Ba-boom. Yeah, there's your idea. Boy, was that an idea. So that's part of it. It's easy to take in.
It's a perfect length of poem, you could argue, for a world with increasingly short attention spans.
Well, that's right. And, you know, we don't actually necessarily need the Insta poem. In many cases, I'd say I'm just going to be bold because I'm an RTE. We don't need it at all. But the sonnet is, it's a perfect form.
How difficult was it to choose the poems that have ended up in this anthology?
You know, being an anthologist is a thankless task. I've done a few anthologies over the years, and the main complaint, of course, is why isn't so and so in, right? I've done sonnets in which the main anthologies, I should say, in which the main complaint was from someone who was in it, but was complaining that there wasn't enough of them in it compared to somebody else who was in it. So anyway, what I tried to do was to give a sense of, you know, hit the history of the form and some sense of its present glorious period. It's enjoying at this time a real renaissance, particularly in the hands of black poets. Black American sonneteering is enjoying just a fabulous era, and many of them are included in this anthology. But you know what? It might be fun just to go out, as it were, with another reference to Kieran Carson, who's included here. His anthology of selected essays, The Brimming World, has just come out. I think you may be looking at it in this program one of these days. But this is a sonnet by Kieran Carson, just rounding out the northern horde there, with Spencer's Ireland. Ray Kelly horse boys, Kearns, Gallow Glasses, Carrows, bards, captains, rapparees, their forward womenfolk, swords, dice, whiskey, chess, harps, word hordes, bows and arrows, all are hid within the foldings of their Irish cloak. Fit house for an outlaw, meat bed for a rebel, this whore's wardrobe is convenient for a thief, and when it freezes it becomes his tabernacle, in whose snug he finds Hibernian relief. Then there is this big thick bush of hair hanging down over their eyes, a dlib, they call it in their speak. They do not recognise the power of the crown. At the drop of a hat, they are wont to vanish into deep, dark woods, forever on the make. They drink and talk too much. Not all of it is gibberish.
Paul Muldoon, it's always wonderful to have you on Arena. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
We will be talking to the editor of The Brimming World by Kieran Carson, his collection of essays, the poet Gail McConnell, on Arena next Wednesday. New selected poems by Maeve McGuckian is published by Gallery Press, and the poems of Seamus Heaney, Namanlap by Tom Paulin, and Scanty Plot of Land, edited by Paul Muldoon, are all published by Faber. And you're listening to Monday Night's Arena. It's 50 years since Queen topped the charts with All Glorious 7 Minutes of Bohemian Rhapsody, catapulting the band to global stardom. Freddie Mercury, John Deacon, Brian May and Roger Taylor became one of the most successful acts of the 1970s and 80s, bringing us hit after brilliant hit, and fronted by Freddie as an utterly dazzling, flamboyant figure who was worshipped and adored by millions across the world. A Night at the Opera is the iconic album on which Bohemian Rhapsody features, and arts journalist Pat Carty is here as we mark its 50th anniversary. Pat, A Night at the Opera is an album that defined that early success period of Queen. Talk to me first about where the album title comes from.
Album title is from, apparently they were sitting in, while they were recording it, in a place called Rockfield, which is in Wales, and it had a very primitive VCR in it. And you can imagine how primitive this was in 1975. And they were watching a cassette or whatever it was of the Marx Brothers film, A Night at the Opera. And Freddie and Roger looked at each other and said, yeah, that's a good title, we love that. And later on, I think they became friends with Groucho Marx. And Groucho even claimed he liked some of the music. And the next album as well, actually, now that I think about it, is A Day at the Races. Isn't that a Marx Brothers film as well?
Yeah. What's going on for Queen musically and maybe in the broader sense at this particular stage of their career?
Right. Well, Queen had 3 albums out before this, and they'd done fairly well. You know, they had a sizable hit with Killer Queen the year before in 74 from an album called Sheer Heart Attack, which I actually think is a better record. But, you know, let's stick to the chronology here. And but they weren't making any money. But there was a couple of blokes called Barry and Norman Sheffield who owned a place called Trident Studios, and they were making a few bob because they had signed Queen to a contract in 72 or 73 or something like that. That didn't work out very well for Queen. So poor old Freddie said at one point that, you know, he couldn't even afford a piano, which was, how do you live like that at all? So what happened was they were looking around for different managers. They thought about Led Zeppelin's famous manager, Peter Grant, but the idea there would be that they would have had to sign to Zeppelin's record label, and Queen just weren't that kind of band. They're going to play second fiddle to anyone. So in comes John Reid. And John Reid was Elton John, was still at the time Elton John's manager. So you would presume he would have a bit of, he would know how to deal with a flamboyant pop star. He would know how, you know, maybe demanding kind of, I don't want to use the word diva, but that's the word I'm reaching towards here, you know. And so what Reid said to them was, they were in this all this financial trouble and worried. And he said, look, I'm the boss of that. I'll sort out all that. You go off and make the best record you can make. So they were kind of, when coming into this record then, liberated in a way and given free rein, I suppose, to throw everything and sever, you know, go off down to IKEA and buy 7 kitchen sinks and throw it at the wall as well, you know. And that's what came out on this record and why we still listen to it, I think.
So what do we know then about the writing and recording of the album itself?
Right, so they went in and did, they did some strenuous rehearsals, first of all, and then went down to this place, as I say, Rockfield in Wales. And actually, there was a book now that I think of it, last year, the year before, my family and other rock stars, you might remember this, and I'm sorry, the woman's name slipped my mind, but I interviewed her at one of the book festivals, and she was her mother was the chef in this place. So she was there as a young girl, and she can remember them doing all these Galileos and all this as they were outside playing in the yard, and Queen was living there, and she was sneaking down to watch Freddie play the piano late at night, all dressed in white. So it's a very, very varied album. The great thing about Queen, I suppose, is different from many other bands, is there were four songwriters. They were all very strong songwriters. So you have, say, one of the singles from this is My Best Friend, is written by John Deacon, the bass player, the very quiet bass player. I'm in Love with My Cars by Roger Taylor, the drummer. And then Brian May and Freddie shared they wrote the other songs and kind of were driven by each other. Freddie was this kind of, was going through a very inspired time. So it covers everything. You got a bit of Noel Coward, you got hard rock, you got Dixieland jazz, you name it. Rick, it's okay. On this record.
Well, her name is Tiffany Murray. That's been...
There you go,
just
Tiffany
appeared in front of me.
I have to apologise to her if she's listening, because it just slipped my mind.
Before we do anything and before we dig into to the tracks on the album, let's take maybe the iconic song from Side One. This is Queen, and this is You're My Best Friend. Be honest, that's brought a little light into your Monday night. Queen and You're My Best Friend from A Night at the Opera. Let's have a look at some of the tracks on the album that people might be less familiar with, Pat. Yeah. How about Death on Two Legs?
Death on Two Legs, well, that addresses those Sheffield brothers I was talking about earlier on. And Freddie is very, very direct here. He uses lines like, dirty dog with disease, king of sleaze, you took all my money. It's basically about them. And also, the interesting thing there is that that's written by Mercury. And so May would get the credit for writing the guitar riffs and everything on it. But apparently, Freddie sat down at the piano and said, play it like this, do this. You know, and then he used to introduce this. It was always a live favourite. He used to introduce it, and I can't use the complete language here. A real mother something of a gentleman is who he used to dedicate it to. And the record company also thought, Jenny, you can't play that, you know. And actually, one of the Sheffields, even though they're not mentioned by name, thought, no, hold on a second. And he took Queen to court over this one and got an out of court settlement. So they basically admitted it. But what's the point in making a rock and roll record if you can't take the legs out from somebody, you know? That's the whole point of the thing.
What about I'm In Love With My Car?
I'm In Love With My Car, right. Now, this is Roger Taylor singing. It's got one of the best lines of the 70s in a song. At one point he says, I told my girl I'd have to forget her because I needed to buy a new car, Beretta, which nearly rhymes, which is pretty good. And it's a song about his car. It's actually a song about one of the roadies was John Harris was his name, and he had a TR7, which was a Trump TR7. Do you remember those? Which was the love of his life. But the great thing about this song is that Roger Taylor loved it so much that he persuaded Freddie to let him put it on the B-side of Bohemian Rhapsody. Now, in those days when a single, and of course nobody knew Bohemian Rhapsody was going to be such a massive hit, it didn't seem like that at all, but he got equal songwriting publishing for that. So I think there was a bit of hassle later on from the other guys in the band going, how did you get away with that?
Might have been worth a little something.
Yeah, I'd say he got a few bottles of champagne out of that.
Well, then let's have a listen to it. And that's I'm In Love With My Car with Roger Taylor on vocals, which is why you're not hearing Freddie Mercury. Tell me about Seaside Rendezvous.
Seaside Rendezvous, right. Well, there's two kind of Noel Cowardy songs on this. There's one lazing on a Sunday afternoon, should I say. And this Seaside Rendezvous is Freddie again, kind of going back to the... a 30s sound almost, but the two remarkable things going on here. First of all, there's an instrumental section in the middle where you think it's all tubas and things like that, but what it really is Freddie Mercury and Roger Taylor going, and I'll give you just a little example here from myself, all that kind of thing, right? And they're doing all that, and you think, right, well, that's pretty cool, that's amazing they did that. And then there's a tap dancing section, you think, well, that's interesting, you know, people don't do that anymore. But there wasn't any tap dances either. What they had was, again, it was Mercury and Taylor, and they had cymbals, you know, like sewn cymbals. And they just tapped them on the, I don't know if people can hear that at home, just tapped them on the desk in the thing. So, you know, you didn't get much of this kind of crack from Alice Cooper or anything like that, you know.
What about Love of My Life?
Love of My Life. Okay, well, that's a widely covered song. And it was one of those ones when they used to play live that Freddie didn't even really have to sing it. He just let the crowd take over. Now, there's two possible things that this is about. It could be about Mary Austin, who was Mercury's girlfriend at the time and was his pal for life. And I think she was a serious beneficiary, along with his cats, in his will. And, or, It could be, as John Reed said, about an executive from EMI called David Minns. And David Minns was Freddie's first serious male relationship. But of course, Freddie, like all these songs, and like any great artist, would never tell you what it was about.
Okay, let's have a listen to it. Here we go. Now, we've mentioned it already, Bohemian Rhapsody is on this album. Set that up for us.
Yeah, well, the Bohemian Rhapsody. Now, obviously, everybody listening to this probably never needs to hear Bohemian Rhapsody again because it's so tattooed into your psyche already, you know, whether it be in Wayne's World or whatever. But it's a bizarre thing. He said, the legend goes that he was talking to producer Roy Thomas Baker and played it to him on the piano and stopped in the middle and said, now, this is the bit where the opera goes. And Roy Thomas Baker went and said, yeah, of course it is. Yeah, that's what's next. So it's divided into three sections. You have the bit at the start where Freddie's at the piano. And he admits, I'm not sure, does he admit to murder or is his mama who was admitted? What do you think? Is it mama who admits to murder?
I think it's mama, comma, just killed a man is my presumption, it always has been.
And then you have the bit in the middle where it goes bananas with the opera. And then you have the kind of hard rock bit where everyone headbangs in the end. Now, there's a fantastic cast of characters here. And this being an art show, I think this is what we should concentrate on here. So he's never, again, he's never said what it's about. But you have Scaramouche, who is the clown from the Commedia dell'arte, as you knew, and I don't doubt that. Galileo, of course, the astronomer. Figaro from Beaumarchais, the Barber of Seville, and the marriage of Figaro. And, of course, Beelzebub is Satan in the New Testament, I think. And even Bismillah, if I'm pronouncing that right, is a noun taken from the Quran. So, again, you don't get, you know, you could listen to a lot of Coldplay records, you're not going to hear that. Do you know what I mean?
I will get into trouble if I don't play at least little bit of this. Here's Bohemian Rhapsody. And I know we're in trouble for not playing the rest of that, but unfortunately that's the nature of it. Bohemian Rhapsody went to number one, so did the album, and it was at Christmas. It was the success of the album was huge.
Yeah, they got a bit fed up with it actually, with being number one, because I think Bohemian Rhapsody as a single broke all sorts of records. I think it was 6 or 7 weeks or something like that. And then they had the record followed, and of course it went up the charts, but crucially it went up the charts in America as well. And there was a huge tour, which culminated, in they played a free gig in Hyde Park, and there was about 350,000 people there. So was that the coronation of Queen, Rick? What do you think? After that, it was a kind of calling card for them, because after that, they could go and play anywhere. You know, before that, they were a well-known band, but after that, they were superstars.
Arts journalist Pat Carty, thank you for celebrating 50 years of A Night at the Opera by Queen with us here on Arena this evening. If you've ever been on the main road from Dublin to Belfast, you'll have passed a sign for the F.E. McWilliam Gallery in Banbridge, just off to the left, about half an hour from Belfast. It's a terrific gallery, often on a touring circuit with Emma in Dublin and the Crawford in Cork. It's currently home to the exhibition 100 Years of British and Irish Art, which is a private collection that's seldom on public view. It belongs to the Earl and Countess of Belmore in Fermanagh and includes paintings by Paul Henry, Nora McGuinness and Mary Swansea, amongst others. Jess Fahey's been to see the show for us. She is now in studio with me. Welcome to Arena, Jess.
Thank you so much.
The F.E. McWilliam Gallery, named after a sculptor who spent much of his life in London, so he isn't terribly well known either north or south on this island, though he deserves to be.
Oh, absolutely. Actually, I think probably one of the most interesting, diverse, extraordinary sculptors from Ireland, in particular because, as I say, his career span lots of different forms, lots of different styles, which is relatively unusual. And in particular, I think when you go to the F.E. McWilliam Gallery, they have an extraordinary collection of smaller models of his work. But what he always said about it, which I really like, is that scale doesn't matter. That if you have something important to say, it doesn't matter if you shout or whisper, as long as it's audible. So when you go there and you look at all these different styles over his career, it's really inspirational and it's really I suppose, kind of nice to see an Irish artist so firmly placed within 20th century modernism and sculpture. He knew lots of famous sculptors and other artists and, you know, was really, again, part of that bigger story of modernism internationally. It is surprising he isn't as well known here, but I think often sculptors aren't as well known here as some of our painters. But one of the most extraordinary series that he ever made was in the 1970s. And you can see various different examples of smaller models as well as some of the larger finished works in the gallery in Banbridge. And this was the Women of Belfast series that he made. Although he was living in Holland Park over in Kensington in London, he was still very aware of what was going on in his homeland in Northern Ireland. And he said he couldn't help but move out of the tranquility of abstraction back into figurative art when he started to become more aware of these news stories, and in particular the tragic events in the Abercorn restaurant in 1972. And these sculptures are of women's bodies that are, you know, sort of distorted, sometimes almost concertinaed, but, you know, it's very clear that the body is being propelled from a blast. But in his construction of them, he very purposely uses drapery to disguise or cover their faces. At first, it looks kind of natural, like real dresses or a top, but the more closely you look, you realise that it's not normal. There's something strange. And he said that the draperies were almost like a metaphor for the event as well, that it's not a normal thing, it's not an acceptable thing, there's something odd going on. And they are incredibly powerful, really, really moving pieces. And with sculpture, you get to walk around it, you get to move around it, and particularly because they don't necessarily follow a naturalism or a logic, you only really get to truly experience that as you move around it. So even without the temporary exhibition that's on, just to go up to see his works is well worth the visit. And they have a recreation of his studio from Holland Park as well in the gardens of the gallery, which is fantastic to see.
Okay, let's dig into that exhibition then. The Earl and Countess of Belmore, they're keen collectors mainly of paintings, and this exhibition is decades of curating them since around about the 1970s?
Exactly. And I think the thing that gives you such a joy of seeing an exhibition like this is that even if we don't all necessarily have the ability to make our own collection, it is a great experience to walk around something like this and sort of peek into someone else's tastes and interests and almost, for me, certainly imagine, well, what would I collect if I could? You know, what ones would I want? And certainly there are themes that can be followed through, but it is more eclectic than that, and it shows you, I suppose, a collector's interest growing and changing over time too. So although as far as I'm made aware of, it was mostly Irish art that he was collecting first, and particularly in relation to Northern Irish artists, local artists, some that he knew very well, like T.P. Flanagan or Basil Blackshaw, for example. And then over time has bought more British artists, perhaps due to the Countess, who herself worked for Christie's, I think, at some point. So these other inspirations or influences coming in to inform how you collect and what you collect.
Okay. As often happens with collectors, they have close connections with many artists. Okay, first and foremost, their friendship with the late Enniskillen-born painter T.P. Terry Flanagan. Who is he?
So he's one of those really interesting Irish artists who I almost sort of takes up a style of art that we wouldn't really have considered since maybe the Georgian period, which is to go to a manor house. So Lissadel would be a very famous one for him as well, and spend time with the family and spend time in the locality making a series of paintings, often in watercolour, but he does work in oils as well, really kind of giving almost like a portrait of the landscape and a portrait of the building, and really intensely so. So it's almost this fascinating way of how an artist, you know, can take something like a landscape but make it something that is through his own lens, very personal, as well as, I suppose, celebrating the locations and the history and all of those things too. So his relationship with Belmore is really interesting because we get to see something that, you know, I would associate as an art historian with someone like George Barrett with the Paris Courts, or James Arthur O'Connor over in Westport. And these are Georgian artists employed by the landed gentry to, you know, paint, here's me and my stuff, basically, you know, the very typical kind of thing we expect of the Georgians. But this is done in a very different way. And we know from Balmore himself talking about their relationship that they formed a true friendship, and he realised with the artist that the artist needed to get to know him in order to get to know the place. So there's a beautiful painting in this exhibition called Balmore's Boat, and it's a watercolour. And in these very subtle washes that at first glance you sort of feel that it's maybe a little bit more kind of impressionist in a way, so very loosely painted. But the closer you get to it, you realise that although there's a very minimal palette, there's only kind of blues, greens and browns, that there's a lot more detail and a lot more going on. And the wash and the confidence of painting in that way starts to become this extraordinary revealing event in front of your eyes as you look at it. So, for example, in this particular work, the boat is, you know, clearly been there for quite some time. It's moored in this boathouse, and there's a reflection in the boat. So there's clearly water is pooled in it of the sky and the landscape around it. But you don't notice that at first until you start to look closer. So it's like the story of the passage of time and the history and the perhaps previous glory days of this, you know, land of gentry being revealed in such a simple little detail in the painting.
I'm still thinking about Here's Me and My Stuff. That's going to stick with me for quite some time.
I think Gainsborough, you know, they're always painted the people with their stuff in the background, yeah.
Terry Flanagan isn't the only landscape artist in the show. There's Paul Henry. He may have been born in the north, but he's strongly associated with the west of Ireland. Describe for us the painting, A View of Crowpatrick from Achill Island.
It's tiny, for a start, which is a really lovely thing to see, because I think there's a kind of particular size we expect of Paul Henry, almost kind of, you know, small window size, you know, but not really miniature as this one is. And there's something of reducing such a vast landscape that he's painting into a miniature, which makes it a fascinating, you know, sort of experiment in its own right. But what it does is use the colour blue and similar pared down palette to what we were saying about Flanagan, but in Henry's, it's just flatter, more, as we sort of call it, graphic, less painterly. And this in part comes from what we know about Henry's training. He trained in Paris, and one of his teachers was Alphonse Mucha, of the famous sort of Art Nouveau posters. So that kind of poster style of flattening things down to something that would be easier to print, almost, to sort of think about it in those kind of terms. But on top of that, his other inspiration in Paris was Whistler, James McNeill Whistler, who very famously pushed back against the typical rules of, you know, perspective within landscape, and, you know, got in quite a lot of trouble over what others believed to be throwing a pot of paint in the face of the public. In other words, not following the typical rules. So we see those influences in this work by Henry, but it is still undeniably Paul Henry. And there's something really fascinating about an artist who I think most people would be able to recognise. They'd recognise his style immediately, even when it's on this small scale. And this is almost just like a symphony in blues. You know, it's all these different shades of blue, showing you the mountain in the background, the sea in the foreground, and then a cloudy grey sky above. And all of those slightly different shades of blue just making it really beautiful, fascinating thing to look at, and showing you, I think, really a lot of his ability and skill as an artist, even on this small scale.
Letitia Hamilton might be a lesser known artist, but she's represented here as well.
She is. And I should mention the curation of this exhibition is fantastic too, because it makes you make, you know, links and themes and dialogues between these artworks that too often in, you know, public galleries, there's a sense of having to have geographic or chronological order. Whereas with a private collection, there's much more scope to arrange that however you want to. And in this instance, hers is a few down from that Paul Henry, not too far over from the Flanagan painting. But hers is in a completely different way of painting. So if we think of the light wash of Flanagan or the flat, you know, poster-like surface of Henry, hers is almost sculptural in the way that she applies the paint. So, for example, hers is a view of a horse and cart with a figure going along a street with the mountains and sea in the background. And the cart, when you look at it closely, has been painted with such thick paint that it looks like it, you can almost, you know, feel it like a sculptural construction, which you would never even notice in a reproduction of that painting, incidentally. You kind of have to be there to see it. But her career is really fascinating because she was one of the, you know, most, you know, avant-garde artists, really, in Ireland, that came back to Ireland having having had influence from France and other places. Arguably, in some of her works, the closest we get to an Irish Impressionist, although many others are given that title, none of them are, but she's close to it. In this instance, more post-Impressionist, we kind of get a sense of Vincent van Gogh from it. But her career was often belittled due to her being a woman. And this, you know, treatment of her work being too sweet or too like confectionery, which just isn't true. And when you see her lined up against these other male artists that would never have had those criticisms, you get to really see how that unfair treatment existed for women in this period.
And we have to mention Basil Blackshaw as well, an artist famous for his depiction of rural life in the north and his paintings of dogs and horses. And he only died in 2016.
Yeah, and what the work that's the example here is a really haunting piece. I don't know if it's intentionally haunting, but it has that similar sort of feel to what I was mentioning about Flanagan's washes. In this case, it is oil, but they're mostly brown tones, and it's a group of racehorses in this kind of brown landscape, but there's almost a transparency to them, which is quite unusual and not as typical for his style. It seems a little bit more experimental. It's certainly in terms of influences here, we would see someone like Degas, who also had an obsession with racehorses. And it is a kind of, again, a sort of surprising piece. And again, it makes us think about the choices of the collector, who did know him, in fact, as well. And earlier, Blackshaw had painted the Earl's father after winning a prize for a prize bull, a very good Ulster story. And you get a lovely sense of, you know, that idea of an artist having a friend who's interested in their work, collecting their work, and probably a lot of shared commonality in terms of their, you know, hobbies and what they're interested in, separate art.
We focused on the Irish angle in this show, but of the British artists in the collection, who would you single out?
There's a lot of interesting ones and ones that I didn't necessarily know all that well. Rose Hilton, I think, in particular, was someone that I didn't know her name quite so well. Maybe I'd come across it once or twice before, but her works are fascinating and very much about sort of pushing the boundaries. And her life story is, again, it seems to be informative in relation to this. So she grew up very religious and her artworks don't show that at all. You know, one of them is a woman in this sort of transparent nightdress. And it seems not quite eroticized, but certainly an element of kind of a voyeur sort of element to it. Although the woman herself is sort of collapsed and not paying attention to the painter or the viewer. And on doing a little reading around her, it turns out that her husband, in fact, up until his death in the 70s, didn't let her really paint at all and tried to control and restrict her career because he was an artist and believed there could only be one artist in the family. So it's a fascinating thing to see someone like her who's now getting a lot more recognition. And again, ties in with that story that I just mentioned with Hamilton of how differently women were treated in this time period. And you mentioned at the beginning, Norm McGuinness included here as well. And, you know, her story is similar. You know, she ends up really having a greater career after leaving her husband. And when her and Nana Reid exhibited in the Venice Biennale in 1950, they were complimented on being good enough to be mistaken for male artists. You know, so those stories are always just, you know, an inch away. Or, you know, Mary Swansea is represented in this exhibition too. And she said, you know, if I'd been born Henry instead of Mary, things would have been very different. But to get back to your British artist questions, the placement of Irish artists next to British artists here as well isn't also something we often get to see. And again, it opens up a dialogue and puts them, you know, much more closely connected. We have this assumption often that Irish artists can only be Irish or that's their main identifier. And putting them in this broader context is really interesting and opens up all this, you know, different areas of conversation.
Maybe just very briefly as well, I'd like to bring it all kind of back together. There's a drawing by F.E. McWilliam himself in the Belmore collection as well.
There is, yeah. So this was something that I wasn't as used to kind of seeing drawings by him. And of course, you know, he studied, I think, first in the Belfast School of Art and then over in Slade. So he would have had that typical academic training of, in this case, studying from live figures. But because his works so rarely are that, you know, traditional or academic, it's fascinating to see it. There's actually quite a lot of extraordinary drawings in this exhibition as well. So there's a range of different mediums used by different artists. And again, seeing him in that context and not just as a sculptor is fascinating.
Jess Fahey, brilliant to talk to you again, as usual. 100 Years of British and Irish Art, a Fermanagh collection, is at the F.E. McWilliam Gallery in Banbridge until the 31st of January 2026. For more details, visit arma.com is the website. That is tonight's Arena, produced by Shanna Gorman. Paula Shields is our researcher. Broadcast coordinator tonight was Ollie Hamilton. It was Mark McGrath on sound. I will talk to you same time tomorrow night here from 7 o'clock on RTE Radio 1, where we'll be talking to the winner of this year's Booker Prize, David Salleh, about his book Flesh. John Creedon is next after the news.